A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been watching the last 24 hours unfold, and it's left him with that particular feeling where the official story is too neat, too tidy, and you start wondering if you're watching a geopolitical event or a geopolitical production. Iran launches ballistic missiles at northern Israel in retaliation for an Israeli strike on Beirut's Dahiya suburb. Trump publicly announces he's going to call Netanyahu and tell him not to retaliate. Israel retaliates anyway, hitting an Iranian energy facility. Then Trump's team leaks the contents of that call within hours. Then Netanyahu calls off a much larger follow-up strike after Trump warns him he'd be on his own. Then both sides announce they're halting, and the whole thing wraps up in roughly a news cycle. Daniel's question is basically, what are we actually looking at here? Who's the audience for this performance? And what does it tell us about where this simmering mess is actually headed?
The sequence violates so many norms of crisis diplomacy that you have to either assume total incompetence or deliberate staging. And I think the evidence points toward the second. Let me lay out what actually happened, because the timeline matters. Sunday, June 7th, Israel strikes two apartment buildings in Dahiya. That's the seventh Israeli strike on that suburb since January, by the way, per ACLED data. Hezbollah had been hitting northern Israel with rockets and drones for weeks. Sunday evening, Iran fires salvos of ballistic missiles at northern Israel, 24 missiles total, all intercepted or landing in open areas. Then the extraordinary part, before the missiles have even finished falling, Trump gives an interview to Axios and says, quote, "I am going to call Bibi right now and tell him not to retaliate. Each of them had their fun. Israel had its strike, and Iran had its strike. We don't need another one."
He used the word fun. 24 ballistic missiles and two countries on the edge of a regional war, and the framing is they've had their fun.
That's the first signal that something strange is happening, because normally, a president doesn't announce a private diplomatic intervention before he's made it. You make the call, you resolve the crisis, and then maybe you leak the outcome. You don't pre-leak the ask, but Trump announced what he was going to tell Netanyahu before he told him. That means the public framing was as important as the private diplomacy, maybe more important.
The question becomes, who needed to hear him say that? Because it wasn't Netanyahu. Netanyahu was about to get the call directly. The audience was someone else.
And then Israel strikes anyway. Early Monday morning, the IDF launches what they called extensive airstrikes against Iranian air defense systems and a petrochemical complex in Mashhad, southwest Iran. The IDF said the plant produced unique materials that serve as critical components for the development of ballistic missiles. The Israeli ambassador to Washington tweeted, quote, "No self-respecting country in the world would tolerate such an attack, and neither will Israel. So now, you have a public defiance of a public request."
The target choice is the next signal. They didn't hit a military base. They didn't hit a Revolutionary Guard facility. They hit an energy facility. Bandar Abbas Oil Terminal, which handles 80% of Iran's crude exports. That's not a tactical retaliation. That's a message about long-term economic degradation. Energy infrastructure takes years to rebuild. You don't hit that unless you want the other side to know you're thinking in years, not days.
And then we get the leak. Trump's team doesn't just confirm the call happened, they release the specific ask. They tell reporters he urged restraint, that Israel defied him, that he warned Netanyahu he could be left to fight alone. Channel 12 in Israel gets the full play-by-play fighter jets on the runway. A massive follow-up strike approved, Trump calls, Netanyahu calls it off, considerable confusion within the military high command. The level of operational detail in that leak is astonishing. You're reading about jets on runways within hours of the decision.
Let's do the game theory lens on this. In signaling theory, a costly signal is one that's expensive to fake. A public leak of your own failed diplomatic intervention is a costly signal. It makes you look weak. No president wants to look like he asked an ally to do something, and the ally said no. So why would Trump's team leak that? Either it's incompetence, someone on his staff is trying to undermine him, or the appearance of weakness is the point.
Or it's a coordination signal dressed up as a leak. Think about what the leak actually does. It lets Trump say to his base and to the international community, I tried to stop this. I'm the responsible one. I'm the adult restraining a trigger-happy ally. Meanwhile, Netanyahu gets to tell his domestic audience, I defied the Americans. I struck Iran. I stood up for Israeli security. Both leaders get the narrative they need for their respective political bases. The leak isn't a failure of diplomacy. The leak is the diplomacy.
The Axios quote from the U.S. official is doing a lot of work here. Bibi needs the war to continue to stay politically alive in Israel, and Trump needs the war to end to stay politically alive in the U.S. That's not analysis, that's a U.S. official saying the quiet part out loud. Both leaders have domestic incentives that point in opposite directions, and the public drama reconciles them.
The reconciliation mechanism is the leak itself. Let me compare this to historical precedents, because the pattern is instructive. In 2013, Obama's Syria Red Line, the leak about Assad's chemical weapons use, came from the intelligence community, and it was designed to force Obama's hand toward military action. The leak was from below, pushing upward. In 2023, Biden's private warnings to Israel during the Gaza campaign stayed private. The norm held, private diplomacy stayed private. What we saw this week is the exact inversion. The leak comes from the top. It's about the president's own request, and it reveals a failure, not a success. That's unprecedented.
It's the third such leak in 18 months. The 2024 Gaza ceasefire negotiations had two similar episodes where the contents of Trump-Netanyahu calls ended up in the press within hours. This is a pattern now. It's not a bug in the system. It's a feature.
If we accept that this is at least partly a performance, the next question is the one Daniel's really asking. Who's the audience? And the answer is, there are multiple audiences, and they're all watching different parts of the show.
Walk me through them.
First audience, the Israeli domestic public. Netanyahu's coalition depends on Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich. The security cabinet was reportedly split. Ben-Gvir argued Israel should stand our ground against Trump, while Smotrich wanted to focus on Hezbollah in Beirut rather than Iran directly. Netanyahu reportedly told Ben-Gvir his position was influenced by the approaching election campaign, so Netanyahu needs to look like he's standing up to American pressure while also looking like he's not actually starting a regional war. The sequence gives him both. He strikes, then he calls it off. He gets to say, as he did in his video address, that the fire on this front has been halted because Iran stopped attacking after being struck. He frames stopping as victory.
Second audience, Trump's domestic base. He gets to say he called the shots. His quote to the Financial Times, I call the shots. I call all the shots. He doesn't call the shots. That's for a Republican primary audience that wants to see American strength. But he also gets to say he restrained Israel, which appeals to the part of his coalition that's skeptical of foreign entanglements. The public plea for restraint is the policy and the press release at the same time.
Third audience, Iran's hardliners. They fired 24 ballistic missiles, none of which caused casualties, and then Israel struck their energy infrastructure. The regime can claim they responded forcefully to the Dahiyeh strike, while also being able to point to the damage and say, see, this is what happens when you engage with the Americans. They let Israel hit us anyway. Every conventional strike that doesn't target nuclear facilities but hits economic infrastructure actually strengthens the argument of the Iranian faction that says nuclear weapons are the only real deterrent.
Which brings us to the nuclear piece. The entire 24-hour cycle. Missiles, petrochemical strikes, Trump's steel-making rhetoric conspicuously avoided Iran's nuclear program. And Daniel's point is exactly right. Until the nuclear material is addressed, the threat isn't neutralized. It's being deferred.
Let me put some numbers on this, because the timeline matters enormously. The IIII's June 2026 quarterly report estimates Iran's breakout time at 3 to 6 months. They have 60 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium stockpiled as of May 2026. 60% is not weapons grade. You need 90%. But the enrichment cascade from 60 to 90 is much shorter than from natural uranium to 60. They've done most of the work already. The Fordow facility is buried under 90 meters of rock. The Natanz enrichment hall is hardened. These are not targets you can take out with the kind of strike we saw this week.
Here's the uncomfortable math. Every conventional strike that hits energy infrastructure, but doesn't touch the nuclear program, actually accelerates the logic of going nuclear. Iran's leadership now has proof. They can fire 24 ballistic missiles at Israel and get their oil terminal bombed in return. Conventional deterrence didn't work. The missiles didn't cause casualties, but Israel still escalated. From the Iranian perspective, what's the argument against racing for a bomb at this point? What have they got to lose?
That's the knock-on effect that I think most of the coverage is missing. The headlines are about defiance and drama and oil prices jumping back above $97 a barrel. Brent crude was up nearly 5% after the Mashar strike. But the real story is what this does to the Iranian nuclear calculus. Let me compare two historical cases. In 1981, Israel struck the Osirak reactor in Iraq. The operation was secret until after execution. In 2007, Israel struck the Al-Kabar reactor in Syria, also secret until afterward. Both strikes hit nuclear facilities directly, and both were kept quiet until the bombs had already fallen. Compared to 2026, everything is public in real time. Trump announces his call before he makes it. Israel announces its strikes as they happen. The ambassador tweets about it. The norm of operational secrecy is gone.
That changes the nature of deterrence entirely. If everything is public, everything is a signal. You can't separate the military operation from the political communication, because they've become the same thing. The strike on the petrochemical plant wasn't just about degrading missile production capacity. It was a message to Iran's leadership that Israel can hit their economic lifeline whenever it wants. The public nature of the strike is the escalation.
Let's talk about the strike that didn't happen, because that might be the most revealing detail of the whole sequence. Channel 12 reported that Netanyahu had approved a massive follow-up strike on Iran for later Monday. Fighter jets were on the runway. Trump called and told him to halt, warning that Israel could be left alone. Trump told Channel 12 directly, "I said, Bibi, you better be careful or you will be on your own very soon." Netanyahu called off the operation and there was, quote, considerable confusion within the military high command.
Considerable confusion is a diplomatic way of saying the generals had no idea why they were being told to stand down after being told to go, which suggests the decision-making wasn't happening through normal military channels. It was happening in a phone call between two leaders who were both, simultaneously, managing the public perception of that phone call.
And here's where the performance theory gets its strongest support. If the massive follow-up strike was real and Trump genuinely stopped it, then the public saw only a fraction of what was planned, which means the escalation was much closer to a full-scale war than anyone outside the room knows. If the massive strike was a bluff designed to be called off, then the entire sequence was choreographed to let Netanyahu look aggressive and Trump look restraining, with neither of them actually wanting the big war. From the outside, these two interpretations are indistinguishable, and that indistinguishability is itself useful.
It's the strategic ambiguity applied to your own decision-making process. We don't know if you're a madman or a rational actor, and the uncertainty is the deterrent.
Nixon's madman theory, but updated for the social media age, perform your internal deliberations in public so that no one can tell what's real and what's theater.
Let's pull on the thread of what this means for the Gulf states, because they're the audience nobody's talking about. Saudi Arabia and the UAE are watching this sequence and drawing conclusions about American reliability. If the US president publicly asks Israel not to escalate, and Israel escalates anyway, and then the US doesn't impose any visible consequences, what does that tell Riyadh?
It tells them the US security guarantee is conditional in ways that are not transparent. And that accelerates the hedging behavior we're already seeing. There were rumors in May 2026 about a Saudi-China defense pact. The Gulf states have been diversifying their security relationships for years, buying Russian air defense systems, deepening military cooperation with China, maintaining back channels with Iran. Every episode like this pushes them further in that direction.
Because from their perspective, the question isn't whether the U.S. is strong enough to protect them. It's whether the U.S. is willing to constrain Israel in a way that prevents a regional war that would destabilize them. And the public evidence of the last 48 hours suggests the answer is maybe not, or at least not reliably.
The oil markets are pricing this in real time. Brent crude jumping 5% on the Mashar strike isn't just about supply disruption risk. It's about the market starting to price in the possibility that the U.S. can't keep a lid on this conflict. If the Gulf states start to believe that too, the entire architecture of U.S. alliances in the region starts to shift.
Let's address the nuclear question head-on, because Daniel's framing of it, until the nuclear material is extracted from Iran, needs some unpacking. The language of extraction is a bit misleading. Enriched uranium isn't extracted, it's produced in centrifuges. You can't just go in and remove it like you're defusing a bomb. The material is distributed across multiple facilities, some of which are hardened and buried. A real nuclear strike on Iran would be a massive operation. Not a few airstrikes on a petrochemical plant.
That's the gap in the public conversation. Trump has said he's very close to a deal, or I'm going to blow the hell out of them. He's demanded a halt to Iran's nuclear ambitions. But what does a deal actually do about the 60 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium that already exists? You can't unenrich uranium. You can ship it out of the country. That's what the 2015 JCPOA did with Iran's 20% stockpile, sending it to Russia. But the political conditions for that kind of agreement are completely different now. Iran in 2026 is not Iran in 2015. They've been under maximum pressure for years. Their economy is battered. Their proxy network has been degraded. They have fewer cards to play, which could make them more willing to deal or more desperate.
Desperation is the variable that makes the nuclear timeline unpredictable. If Iran's leadership concludes that conventional deterrence is broken and diplomatic deals won't protect them, the rational move is to sprint for a weapon. The breakout time of 3 to 6 months assumes they're enriching at their current rate. If they kick it into high gear, add centrifuges, increase enrichment to 90%, that timeline shrinks dramatically.
Here's the uncomfortable conclusion. The public drama of the last 24 hours, the pre-announced phone calls, the leaked defiance, the canceled massive strike, may actually be making a nuclear Iran more likely, not less. Because every conventional escalation that doesn't address the nuclear program tells Tehran that the only thing that will stop Israel from striking is a nuclear deterrent, and they're 3 to 6 months away from having one.
Unless the performance is designed to make them overplay their hand, that's the alternative theory. If you're Trump, and you want to justify a much larger military operation, including strikes on nuclear facilities, you might want Iran to look maximally threatening first. You might want them to accelerate enrichment, to kick out inspectors, to give you the casus belli. The public drama softens up the domestic audience for what comes next.
Trump's rhetoric supports that reading. We're very close to a deal, or I'm going to blow the hell out of him. That's not diplomatic language. That's an ultimatum dressed as a negotiation. The deal and the threat are the same sentence.
We've got three possible readings of what's actually happening. One, this is a genuine breakdown in coordination between the US and Israel, and the public leaks are evidence of real internal conflict. Two, this is a coordinated performance where both leaders are playing to their domestic audiences, and the apparent conflict is choreographed. Three, this is a setup for a much larger operation, and the public drama is building the political justification for strikes on nuclear facilities. From the outside, all three are plausible, and that's the point.
Let me give listeners a framework for decoding which of these is actually happening, because I think there are observable indicators we can track. I'm going to call it the leak test. When a private diplomatic request is leaked in real time, ask two questions. First, who benefits from the leak? Not who's embarrassed by it, who benefits? Second, is the leak directed at the public or at a specific third party? If the leak benefits the leaker's domestic political position, it's probably a performance. If the leak seems designed to signal to Iran or the Gulf states or China, it's probably strategic communication. If it benefits no one and just makes the leaker look weak, it might actually be genuine dysfunction.
That's a useful heuristic. And if you apply it to this sequence, Trump's team leaked his own failed request. Trump benefits domestically by looking like the responsible peacemaker. Netanyahu benefits domestically by looking like the defiant defender. The leak benefits both of them. That points toward performance.
The second framework is what I'd call the target selection heuristic. When a state strikes infrastructure instead of military assets, they're signaling long-term intent to degrade, not short-term tactical advantage. The Mashar petrochemical plant. The IDEF said it produced materials for ballistic missiles, which is true, but it's also a civilian economic asset. Hitting it sends a message about economic vulnerability, not just military capability. It says, we can hurt you in ways that take years to recover from. That's a different game than retaliation.
The third thing to watch is the IAEA's next quarterly report, due in September 2026. If Iran's enrichment rate spikes, if they go from 60% to 90%, or if they add significant centrifuge capacity, then the conventional strikes accelerated the nuclear timeline, the performance theory loses weight, and the genuine escalation theory gains it. If the enrichment rate holds steady, if Iran stays at 60% and doesn't kick out inspectors, then the performance theory gains weight, because it suggests Iran understood the drama was partly for show and chose not to overreact.
That's the concrete, observable indicator. You don't need to guess about intentions. You can watch the centrifuges. If the number of operating centrifuges at Natanz and Fordow increases in the next IAEA report, Iran is racing. If it stays flat, they're playing the same game of managed tension that everyone else is playing.
There's one more layer here that I think is worth pulling on. The US official who told Axios that Bibi needs the war to continue and Trump needs it to end. That quote isn't just analysis. It's a US official, on the record with a major outlet, publicly diagnosing the political incentives of an allied leader. That's an extraordinary breach of diplomatic norms. You don't say that about an ally unless you want to be heard saying it.
It's a signal directed at the Israeli public, not at Netanyahu. It's saying, your prime minister has personal political reasons for keeping this conflict going. Don't trust his framing. That's the US trying to influence Israeli domestic politics through the press. It's not even subtle.
Which brings us back to the audience question. If the US is signaling to the Israeli public that Netanyahu's incentives are political, and Netanyahu is signaling to his coalition that he stands up to American pressure, and Iran is signaling to its hardliners that the resistance continues, and the Gulf states are watching all of this to decide whether to hedge further toward China, then the actual military operations are almost secondary. They're props in a political theater.
The norm that's died here is private diplomacy. The phone call between a U.S. president and an Israeli prime minister used to be the most secure channel in the relationship. Now it's being pre-announced, live-leaked, and post-game analyzed by both sides within hours. Every future crisis will be performed in public, which means every escalation is also a negotiation, and every negotiation is also a performance. The distinction between back channel and front stage has collapsed.
Where does this leave the nuclear question? Daniel's point, until the nuclear material is addressed, the threat isn't neutralized, is the thing that hangs over all of this. The missiles, the petrochemical strikes, the phone calls, the leaks, none of it touched the centrifuges spinning at Natanz and Fordow. And if the performance theory is right, that might be by design. The public drama provides cover for a private deal that addresses enrichment. Or it provides cover for a strike that hasn't happened yet. Or it's all genuine chaos, and no one has a plan.
The unsettling thing is, we may never know which parts were real and which were staged. The uncertainty is itself a weapon. If Iran can't tell whether Trump and Netanyahu are at odds or running a good cop, bad cop routine, they can't calibrate their response. If Israel can't tell whether Trump's restraint requests are sincere or performative, they can't fully rely on American support or fully discount American opposition. The fog isn't a bug in the system. It's being generated deliberately.
I want to circle back to one detail that I think gets overlooked. The Dahiyeh strike that started this sequence. It was the seventh Israeli strike on that suburb since January. Seven strikes in 6 months on the same area. That's not a response to an immediate threat. That's a sustained campaign, and Hezbollah had been battering northern Israel with rockets and drones for weeks. The context is a grinding low-level war that occasionally spikes into these dramatic 24-hour episodes. The drama is the exception, but the war is the rule.
That's the structural reality that the public performances are built on top of. Israel and Iran are in a protracted conflict that neither can fully win and neither can fully end. The occasional ballistic missile salvos and petrochemical strikes are punctuation marks in a long-running argument that has no resolution mechanism. The nuclear program is the one variable that could change the entire equation, and it's the one variable that nobody is touching.
If you're tracking this as an analyst, or just as a concerned observer, what should you actually be watching in the next 90 days? I'd say three things. One, The I. IEI. September quarterly report. Enrichment rate. Centrifuge count. Stockpile levels. 2. Whether the Saudi-China Defense Pact rumors solidify into something concrete, because that's the signal that the Gulf states have lost faith in the U.S. security umbrella. 3. Whether the pattern of pre-announced and leaked Trump-Netanyahu calls continues. If it does, the performance theory is confirmed, and private diplomacy is dead.
One more. Watch for any movement on a nuclear deal that addresses the existing stockpile. Trump said he's very close to a deal. If a deal materializes that includes shipping enriched uranium out of Iran, that retroactively changes the meaning of this entire sequence. It would suggest the public drama was pressure building for a negotiation that was already underway.
Or it would suggest the deal was reached after the drama created the conditions for it. The sequence matters. Did the deal exist before the missiles, or did the missiles create the deal?
That's the open question we're left with. If this is a drama, what's the third act? A nuclear test? A U.S.-brokered surprise deal that everyone pretends was a breakthrough? A wider war that resets the regional order? The uncomfortable truth is that all three are on the table, and the public performance is designed to keep them all plausible until someone decides which one is real.
The thing I keep coming back to is that phrase from Trump. Each of them had their fun. 24 ballistic missiles, an oil terminal in flames, fighter jets on runways, and the framing is that they've had their fun. It's either the most cynical diplomatic language I've ever heard, or the most honest, because it treats the whole thing as a game where the violence is real, but the stakes are being managed. And I can't decide which interpretation is more disturbing.
The violence is real for the people in Dahiyeh. 2 dead, at least 17 wounded in the apartment buildings Israel struck. The missiles that landed in open areas in northern Israel could have landed on homes. The fact that the drama might be partly performative doesn't make the consequences less real for the people on the ground. The performance has a body count.
That's the tension at the heart of this. We're analyzing the signaling and the game theory and the domestic political incentives, and those are all real factors shaping the decisions. But the decisions produce real violence. The analytical framework doesn't sanitize that. It just explains the logic producing it.
To answer Daniel's question directly, what we can observe from this chaotic turn of events is a pattern of public signaling that serves multiple domestic audiences simultaneously, at the cost of making the actual strategic picture harder to read. The confusion isn't a failure of analysis. The confusion is the product. And where it leaves the simmering mess is exactly where it was, except with more centrifuges spinning, less trust between allies, and a norm of private diplomacy that's been replaced by something that looks more like professional wrestling. Real violence, real stakes, but a script that nobody outside the ring can fully see.
If you found this useful, share it with someone who thinks they understand what's happening in the Middle East. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
Byzantine court ceremonial required that anyone approaching the emperor prostrate themselves fully, a practice called proskynesis, which was adapted from Persian court ritual. This foreign borrowing had an unintended consequence. It became a theological flashpoint when Western Christians interpreted the prostration as idolatrous emperor worship, deepening the cultural rift between the Latin and Greek churches that eventually contributed to the Great Schism.
A borrowed gesture of respect accidentally helped split Christianity in half.
The Byzantines really knew how to commit to a bit.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. stay curious, keep weird in mind.